Welcome to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program showcasing radio productions of this and many other independent community stations across the country. We bring local stories to a national audience from a different location every week. I'm Dori Smith of Talk Nation Radio Studios with co-producer David Hazeltine of Pacifica affiliate WHUS, FM 91.7 in Storrs, Connecticut.
We're talking about endless war here.
That's the exact same policy that the Bush administration had. Exactly the same.
The president, after a couple of days, came out with some very strong language, strongly condemning the violence.
Today on Sprouts, we sample important conversations taking place in community radio forums as the foreign policy strategies of President Obama and Vice President Biden become more clear. Peace activists, progressive Democrats, international scholars, and independent journalists who covered Bush and Cheney policies critically have now become increasingly critical about new U.S. policies. America appears to be withdrawing from Iraq, but is it a true withdrawal, or will U.S. forces remain in Iraq as a partial occupying force, managing oil deals and operating bases from which U.S. forces will now prosecute a more regional war? Vietnam veteran and Vet for Peace Camillo Mack Bica has worked tirelessly to end U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He now finds himself frustrated by President Obama's arguments for escalating the Afghan war and using drones in Pakistan.
It's come to the point now when even the President of the United States is saying that the war in Iraq was a mistake, or that it's a war of choice. And wars of choice are illegal and immoral. It's a war crime. We have to take that seriously. Now, it's been sold to us as something that other than that. We were told that it's national interest and it's national defense, and we have to stop them there before the mushroom cloud in New York City or something. And what's sad is that some of that rhetoric still exists within the Obama administration. Obama, in his new strategy on Iraq and Afghanistan, talks very specifically about the fact that Al-Qaeda still exists, and they're still a threat, a very serious threat, and they are plotting to kill massive numbers of people from their safe havens in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So we're hearing the same kind of rhetoric. There is no change there. So that's disheartening. We've been given this illusion of these wars as necessary for our security, necessary for our survival. One thing we need to get clear about, I think, is that Iraq and Afghanistan and instability in Pakistan is not an existential threat. In other words, it's not going to threaten the survival of the United States of America or global insecurity. And it's a problem that needs to be dealt with regionally. And it's a problem that should not be equated to Nazi Germany. It's a problem that should be equated to some sort of criminal conspiracy, some international religious-motivated criminal conspiracy. And criminal conspiracies should be dealt with not militarily through invasion, but should be dealt with through some sort of well-funded and well-coordinated police work. And I think that's where we need to go on this. That's where we need to get clear about the reality of the situation. It's been portrayed to us as being some sort of major existential threat, that our very survival, the very survival of our values and everything we stand for is at risk here. So we need to act, and we need to act now. That was the kind of language that we've been living with, and I fear that it hasn't changed all that much. So we need to understand the reality of what we face. And then once we understand the reality of what we face, maybe we can make better decisions on how to deal with it. Now, I'm not saying let's become isolationists. Let's hide our heads in the sand and not accept the realities. The world is a complex place, and some issues need to be dealt with. But war isn't the answer. We're talking about endless war here. It's Orwellian, and it's a war like any other. I mean, the enemy terrorists are an enigmatic group. I mean, there's no structure there. It's loosely affiliated units and individuals who prosecute violence. So how do you determine victory?
Vietnam went on for many, many years. The United States secretly bombing Cambodia and Laos, Americans finding out about it gradually. And then when American forces were finally trapped in Saigon waiting for helicopters in that dramatic time, I think a lot of people were asking themselves, what will happen next? But in fact, what happened next, you know, the war didn't come home. There wasn't the domino effect. What we saw was a country and a region that rebuilt itself basically without a lot of U.S. involvement, but there was some there eventually. But I mean, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, these were not countries where the populations rose up and began to take out their anger about the war on America. What about the region of the Middle East? Can we walk away? Can American forces pull out? And if they do, can you compare now the history of Vietnam to sort of predict what might happen in the Middle East?
Yeah, I think that's one of the arguments that is used when we talk about staying the course. It's almost structured as a moral argument. Well, we caused all this instability and chaos, and now we just can't walk away from that. It's just part of our arrogance to think that our continued occupation, our continued killing and destroying, is somehow saving people from themselves. And should we leave, insanity will completely break out, and there'll be massive killings and destruction. Look, there's over 1 million people dead as a result of our actions. How much worse can it be? Should we leave? People realize that we are not part of the solution. And if we are a catalyst to the violence, when we like to think of ourselves as thwarting it, probably our absence will help lessen the violence. At least it will be a first step for the Iraqis and the Afghanis to have to do something now to bring some sort of stability to their country. And alien neighbors will have to support as well. No one's saying just leave like we left after the Soviet involvement. We just walked out on people after we caused all that chaos during the 80s and left the country in a vacuum that the Taliban stepped in. Look, let's have a surge of doctors. Let's have a surge of teachers. Let's have a surge of humanitarian development and reconstruction. We don't need a surge of military. It's not about more bombing. It's not about bigger bombs and more people to kill. It's about creating jobs. It's about winning the hearts and minds of the people. That's where the answer lies. And you don't win the hearts and minds when you blow up villages and kill women and children. You alienate and create people who want to kill you. And that's not the solution. So let's get out. Will there be some instability and unrest? Of course there will be. Will it be all that worse than it is right now? I'm not sure. I tend to think that there will be a surge of instability, and as the power brokers manipulate themselves within the infrastructure, things will settle down some. I just don't see us as being part of the solution there.
Peace activists like Camilo Macbica are not alone in their sharp criticism of Obama policy. On July 6th, one of Britain's most senior judges, Lord Bingham, said U.S. drones used in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Gaza, as well as U.S. cluster bombs and landmines, are, quote, beyond the pale and should probably be banned by the international community. His statements appear in the British paper The Independent.
I've hardly heard a squeak from Congress in opposition to this war.
Sherwood Ross of Anti-War News Service writes that President Obama has no legal authority to escalate the Afghan war and that he's creating a humanitarian catastrophe in Pakistan.
The government is supposed to ask the permission of Congress under the War Powers Resolution to make the war, to escalate the war, and they have not done this.
Sherwood Ross also looking at headlines about the ongoing SALT talks between President Obama and Russian President Medvedev. He saw a downside to America's agreement for ongoing use of Russian territory to supply U.S. forces in Afghanistan.
It seems to me that this is cynical power politics on the part of two major powers, Russia and the United States. The people who are going to suffer from the shipment of war materials across Soviet territory, Russian territory rather, into Afghanistan will be the people of Afghanistan, particularly the Pashtun tribesmen and there is no legal authority from the United Nations for this war. The United States has no congressional authority for the war. And it just hurts me that the Russian people, who themselves know so much about the horror of war and have suffered as greatly as they have in the Great Patriotic War of the 1940s, that their government should be cooperating with the United States in the movement of these war materials. This is the last thing that the people of Afghanistan need, and it should not be done in their name, which the United States is doing.
Longtime journalist Sherwood Ross worked for Reuters as well as for the Chicago Daily News. He now runs Anti-War News Service. At Foreign Policy Journal Online, Jeremy Hammond has been tracking U.S. support for Iran's protest movement, web programs that seem highly political and may have the same flavor as the Tea Party movement process we saw on Tax Day recently in America, plus the growing attention being paid by America's media that has come to mirror a program begun under Bush as a propaganda effort run by Elizabeth Cheney, daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney.
There has been a shift in rhetoric. There's been a shift in the language. But the goal remains the same. They still want regime change. And if you look at, you know, Obama has said he wants to talk to the Iranians. Well, that's different. Bush said he wouldn't talk to the Iranians. But what does Obama want to talk to them about? He says, I want to sit down at the table with them, and we're going to tell them you need to stop enriching uranium. And we're going to talk about that. That's the foundation of the dialogues that have been proposed. Well, that's not a negotiation. That's the exact same policy that the Bush administration had, exactly the same. So this idea that the Obama administration has shifted policy towards Iran, there's really just no indication that that's true. And that's an important point because, again, these policies of regime change towards Iran in support for opposition groups and these covert operations taking place, you know, some people might assume that Obama would put an end to those, but I don't make that assumption. You know, for all we know, those operations are still taking place.
Iranian-American scholar Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian-American Council, has been making lots of radio appearances. He participated in a news program on NPR's Talk of the Nation June 30th.
Of all the different emotions Iranians have experienced, going from hope and excitement at the beginning to despair and anger and frustration after seeing the images of the brutality of the government, one emotion stands out throughout, which is pride. Pride at seeing the courage of the demonstrators, pride at seeing people from all walks of life, all age groups, all classes coming out and say, look, this is not okay and we're not going to stand for it. Mm-hmm. And what it's done is exactly what the email said. It has given us a nuance about Iran because the image we had here in the United States was quite one-dimensional.
We spoke with Trita Parsi to ask him if there might be a new nationalism growing in Iran, one that extends to the U.S. and other countries, and what the impact might be on both Iranian and U.S. policies.
Iran has always been a very nationalistic country. What you're seeing here is, at the end of the day, a homegrown movement. It's completely indigenous. And as a result, I don't know if nationalism is necessarily the right way of describing it, because they're not reacting towards a foreign threat or anything like that. They're reacting to the brutality of the government itself and the very strong and overwhelming perception that the government committed fraud in these elections.
Trita Parsi and other Iranian-Americans obviously concerned about people in jail, journalists in jail, protesters still in prison in Iran.
The Iranian government itself says that they have imprisoned or detained about 1,100 people. It's probably safe to say that the number is much, much larger than that. There are reports coming out of torture. We're seeing people who are confessing on TV that they were influenced by foreign agents, and in the past it's been rather clear that those confessions are forced confessions. They're not accurate, they're not truthful, and the situation internally with human rights situation deteriorating as quickly as it has is creating a significant problem for the Obama administration to pursue the policy of diplomacy.
I know the Obama administration has had more of an open door, or in some cases maybe an open window, to U.S. social organizations, civic groups, and political ones. But what about your organization? Have you been able to communicate with the Obama people, and at what level?
We've been in contact with the White House about these matters. And we've been, by and large, been quite supportive of what the president has done, but we also felt early on that it was important to be very clear in the condemnation of the human rights violations and brutality taking place in Iran. And sure enough, the president, after a couple of days, came out with some very strong language, strongly condemning the violence. And I think that is absolutely needed. Most of the people we've spoken to in Iran have said that they don't want the United States to interfere or to take sides, but they certainly want to make sure that the violence is condemned.
You know, there's a long history now of the National Endowment for Democracy-funded programs and also USAID, State Department money, going to fund media propaganda and certainly directly for some of these candidates. Would that constitute interference? Is that what they mean?
No, I think what they have primarily tried to argue, which is that these demonstrations were not homegrown, that they had nothing to do with any perceptions of fraud in the elections, but rather that there are elements on the outside that are trying to orchestrate a velvet revolution. I find the Iranian government's argument extremely unconvincing, mindful of the fact that if one takes a look at the demonstrations, etc., they are not terribly well organized. They're not following any particular instructions. They are spontaneous. They are driven by the anger and the frustration of the people. They're not driven by any particular training by any NGO, U.S.-funded or not.
Iranian-American scholar Trita Parsi says his organization, the National Iranian-American Council, does not support any of the candidates or politicians in Iran today. However, they do support new elections, a call made by opposition candidate Mousavi. International law expert Francis A. Boyle has expressed the concern that any U.S. policy in support of an opposition candidate or covert operation in Iran could further destabilize the country and lead to regional war.
We're really seeing a continuation of the overt and covert policies under the Obama administration. And there have been terrorist attacks continuing in Iran under the Obama administration that were going on during the Bush administration, and the Iranian government has blamed these on the United States government, although they haven't done too much about it because they still are hoping that Obama will live up to his word and open some type of diplomatic negotiations with them. I don't know. I guess the Obama administration is going to try to see if they can inflict a color revolution on Iran, figuring that Mousavi and some of the others would be more amenable to their positions across the board than Ahmadinejad has been in the past. Although, you know, in fairness, if you read the letters and statements by Ahmadinejad, he has indicated he is prepared to sit down and negotiate in good faith with the Obama administration. But it does appear he's going to take a somewhat harder line than I guess the Obama people figured Mousavi and some of the others would, if they were in power. So I think this is an attempt to try regime change first, and then, you know, if that doesn't work, things will calm down, and then hopefully start. You recall there was this debate I heard on, I guess it was NPR, National Propaganda Radio, with Liz Cheney involved. Has diplomacy with Iran failed? Well, they've never tried diplomacy with Iran. There's been no diplomacy with Iran going back to the Iranian hostages crisis in 1979.
You're listening to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm Dori Smith of Talk Nation Radio. We turn next to WHUS Public Affairs Director David Hazeltine, who interviewed Cyrus E. Zirakzadeh, an Iranian-American scholar at UConn, the University of Connecticut.
The Iranian government has begun a systematic crackdown on demonstrators, including mass arrest, counter-protest, police and paramilitary, and special courts in which to prosecute demonstrators. The world press has devoted much attention to the demonstrations in Iran, and interactive social media, such as YouTube and Twitter, have played a more vital role than ever before.
بخواب ای خواهرم به
Here with me now is Dr. Cyrus Ernesto Zaraxidi, professor of comparative politics here at UConn and author of several books, including A Rebellious People, Basques, Protests, and Politics, and Social Movements in Politics, A Comparative Study. Welcome to the show, Dr. Zaraxidi.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Are we seeing the beginnings of a revolution in Iran, or as some in the media are saying, is this a short-lived uprising coming to a close in the face of a crackdown against the demonstrations?
That's a good question. I doubt that we're seeing a revolution in Iran, and I also doubt that it's a short-term uprising. I think part of the reason I doubt it's going to be a short-term uprising is there's a tradition in Iran that when someone has died, you recall their lives and their contributions to society on three occasions, 3 days after the death, a week after the death, and then 40 days after the death. And usually in the past, when people have been killed in demonstrations, and there have been scores of people who have been killed, 40 days afterwards, usually those are public displays. And in the past, kind of excitement and concern grows and people take very strong steps. So my guess is that there are going to be some forthcoming demonstrations that are going to be quite large, and they're going to immediately precede the declaration of who will be the next president.
So and when is that?
And that is scheduled for early August.
How do these current demonstrations differ from the large-scale student protests seen in 1999?
In terms of composition of the demonstrations, a wider range of participants from a lot of different social classes. I think that's one important difference. I think the support of the demonstration demonstrators by members of what we would normally consider the conservative portion of the elite, like the leader of the Speaker of Parliament and the mayor of Tehran, I think that's a big difference. So the demonstrators are receiving sympathy from key members of the political elite, including some important clergy. Actually, the crackdown is very complicated because the people who are cracking down aren't regular security guards, but these sort of youth gangs. This is the Basij.
Okay.
Yeah, and they're kind of these voluntary militias. They're very disorganized, and they tend to be made up of men between the age of, let's say, 13 and 30. And they are not regular members of the police or the military, and they're engaged in a lot of violence that's very extra legal and that is offending certain members of the elite. In addition, there have been arrests of a number of prominent former public officials, including one former vice president. There have been arrests of very influential journalists, and there was the temporary detention of the daughter of Ali Rafsanjani, who is a former president of Iran, and it seems like the crackdown has really gone way overboard in the opinion of key conservatives. In terms of public protests, they certainly have been getting smaller, but there are these events that occur in the evening, these calls of God is great down with tyranny, a different type of protest, and actually that seems to be expanding. So it's a different style of expressing defiance and opposition to the regime. And also the clergy are increasingly getting involved and denouncing the behavior of the quasi-official security forces.
Could you go into further detail about the sort of rift that has existed in Iranian society that's been fomenting for some time now?
The Shah of Iran was supported by the United States following a coup in the 1950s, and he pursued a program of economic development that, in terms of product output, really advanced the Iranian economy. Iran increased in the production of all sorts of consumer goods. But a consequence of this was dislocation and loss of employment opportunities, particularly in the countryside. So Iranian cities have expanded rapidly in recent decades and often have these areas of extreme poverty. Supporters of Ahmadinejad, many of them are migrants to the cities. Ahmadinejad himself is from a family that migrated to southern Tehran. Often his supporters fought in the Iraq-Iran war, are suspicious of the United States because of the role of the United States in the Iraq-Iran war and the role of the United States in facilitating the use of chemical weapons by Iraq. They instinctively distrust the United States. And they also feel betrayed because when the war ended, there were not employment opportunities for those who had sacrificed for the good of the regime. So they feel like they have been left out. And in the meantime, they see leaders of the regime, leaders of these foundations through tax policy, rules concerning unions, trade policy, they see these leaders of the foundations becoming immensely wealthy. And they feel that this is a betrayal of the principles of the original principles of the revolution, which was to promote a just society. So they want Rafsanjani and his various supporters, including Mousavi, they want them out of government, and they want a younger group of leaders who are committed to redistribution to be in power. For young adults in Iran is extraordinarily high, double-digit unemployment. Young people are turning to drugs, to prostitution. There's a growing AIDS problem. So there is a lot of dissatisfaction and distress with free market economies. And so in a way, that's natural. The reason that I have my doubts how permanent such politics of resentment can be is that sooner or later you need to have a positive program of how you're going to handle these problems. Right. And Ahmadinejad, his proposals have been fairly utopian. They've backfired. They've actually created new economic problems in Iran.
What ought to be the United States' response to the alleged election misconduct and violence?
I would divide into two types of responses, responses by the government and responses by citizens. I think it's very appropriate for American citizens to express outrage to violations of civil liberties in Iran. There have been very mysterious killings, and I think it's very appropriate for us, through kind of our own associations, human rights organizations, and so forth, to express our concern and our sympathy for those who are victims of what's happening. In terms of the government, I think we really need to be hands off, because if we get involved, it could backfire. Now, why could it backfire? Part of it is geographic. Right now, we have armies on the borders of Iran, in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we've had a recent president call Iran the axis of evil, so there's a lot of suspicion that the United States wants to invade Iran. There are memories of our support for the use of chemical weapons against Iran and also the shooting of a civilian airliner. And so it isn't just what we did in the 1950s that is the reason Iranians are suspicious of us. What we've done in recent decades scares them tremendously. If we verbally side with anyone, it's going to be taken as the first step to our intention of physically interfering. So I think the idea of keeping the government's declaration that we will not get involved in domestic affairs is entirely appropriate. I think if we got involved, it would backfire terribly.
How would you recommend the Iranian regime respond to these protests?
Well, I think what I wouldn't do is continue the crackdown. The people that are now being attacked, like Rafsanjani's own family, I think that's very, very dangerous. Rafsanjani is the head of the Assembly of Religious Experts, and he's also the head of another body we haven't mentioned, the Expediency Council. He's very powerful, and once you're attacking figures like him, you really don't know what's going to happen.
Now, this is a state-sanctioned attack, or is this
It's difficult. For example, it's difficult from a distance to know exactly who detained the daughter. But it was either these youth gangs or it was official security forces. My guess, what is going to happen, is that in the next election for parliament, there is going to be incredible support for reformers. So actually, I think in the long run, something fruitful might occur.
That's it for Sprouts, a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. This program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact Air Traffic Controller Ursula Rudenberg at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Dory Smith with my co-producer David Hazeltine of WHUS Radio in Storrs, Connecticut. Thanks for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.